It says now that if you are in the top 10, you are accepting this $5 million SAFE agreement, and Crosspointe will be an investor via this SAFE right away.
Wait, what? Are you serious?
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Adversarial Podcast. Good to see you guys, as always. Let me kick off with you, Sunil. Anything new going on?
I have a bunch of travel planned overseas. Saudi Arabia, Frankfurt, Greece, and then hopefully flights won't be canceled going into Tel Aviv, because that's my last stop.
Wow, man, that's rolling the dice pretty hard. Is that all through the holidays?
Up until right before Christmas, yeah.
Oh, wow. And that's just all business travel?
Oh, except for Greece. I'm going to try to take a little break.
How about you, Mari? Are you trying to sell cyber on a sailboat in the Aegean Sea as well?
I, after the elections, stopped watching and listening and reading news that if it was not cyber or music, I'm into music and cyber or science articles, I stopped, you know, even radio, anything, nothing on news. And I have been able to focus on reading and finishing three books. I've read three books in 2 weeks.
Big win. All right. Nobody let him in on what the hell's going on. Don't worry, Mario. Cool. Well, let's jump right into it, guys. We got a cool collection of topics here. But one of the things that broke right before we got on the air here, this is pretty interesting, I'd say. RSA is Innovation Sandbox. Right. Every year they have startups that come out there and they vote on them. And then the top 10 come out and they talk to the great audience of target prospects. And Crosspointe bought the RSA conference, I think, in 22, Crosspointe Capital, venture capital firm. And now they've kind of, let's see, when you do M&A, you finally have the integration or the, you know, the platform. So here's the integration between venture capital and RSA. It says now that if you are in the top 10, you are accepting this $5 million SAFE agreement, and Crosspointe will be an investor via this SAFE right away.
Wait, what? Are you serious? I thought it was just a prize.
I've always thought about that. Whenever you see anything where you're like, oh, you win, and it, well, hell, let's step back even further. Anytime someone congratulates somebody for raising money, it's like, well, what are the terms there? You know, it's like, congratulations on buying your house with an 8% mortgage. Like, that's not really congratulations, right? There's always been that and lurking, but at least they're totally, transparent about it.
That's such a perverse incentive here that is being highlighted. I don't know, whoever thought about forcing the contestants to accept essentially an investment, and I don't know whose terms it would be under, right? That's probably another interesting point.
You're asking all the questions I thought of too, and I ripped through a little bit. So I got a few answers in there, a little bit of clarification at least. I'm still of two minds about whether this is a good thing or not. I mean, I do think it makes RSA very unique and kind of like conflicted, sounds like a negative word, but in a legal sense. And there will be more people will kind of go to other venues because that'll be the Crosspointe show, more or less.
That's right.
But the terms out there, for one, it's a SAFE, and it's uncapped, which is kind of cool. So when you accept this, you're getting $5 million, and it's basically saying we're going to convert that into equity at the valuation when you finally go get around to raising. And uncapped means if you then raise at a $500 million valuation, they actually get a pretty small piece of the pie. Mm-hmm. And if you raise at a $20 million, then, oh, shit, they own a quarter of your company here. It's kind of a cool little game. But then the other part is the discount, right? So when they convert in, they're going to get an advantage. They did a sliding scale based on how long you take to raise. And so if you raise within, I think it's 90 days after that event, they only get a 5% discount. If you take more than a year, it's 25% discount, which is what you have to assume. I mean, unless you have a letter in the, you know, in the wings that you just drop right after the thing. You assume it. So assume they're going to get a 25% discount on a $5 million investment. And so it means different things to different companies. It'll be pretty good for some companies, but it's a very small little window of companies that this would be good for. And I think that means that the other 80% of companies aren't going to apply. The one thing that makes a lot of sense about this to me is that if you're in venture and you're spending all your day, you know, looking for deal flow, screening hundreds of companies, you feel some pressure to write checks, to get all that money out that you raised from all the LPs, and that was what they signed up for, and you need to get some alpha, you need to get the money out. You just got 10 investments, boom. You just got $50 million out of your fund that's guaranteed, written out. You don't have to do, you could do some work, but just mutualize. You have all these other judges, everybody else, and those chances are probably at least just as good as going through the regular ringer you'd go through.
I just think that, I don't know how to think about this, but why would I want as a as a company? I mean, you guys are founders. You're giving up part of ownership to this thing. And why? Really, you know, it sounds to me like this is going to be self-selected. Please don't take it the wrong way. But the companies that never got the call back from the other NVCs. Call me, please, yeah. Right? Please call me.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Well, so the other terms, right? So it does say no board seat, okay?
Yeah.
And it does say some pro rata rights. I didn't look into detail of exactly how much that means, but basically be able to ratchet up their investment if you continue on to preserve whatever equity percentage they get at the first conversion. And then it also says, what are the other big things that you'd let this thing? What are the other things you would worry about being in the contract? Oh, information rights. So they're in there getting any investor updates, all that, which seems kind of reasonable. But it does mean if you get into a weird situation where you're going through some M&A or looking at the market and looking at competitors and they're all of a sudden conflicted, then that gets a little bit complicated. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's for them, it makes perfect sense. I mean, they've got to monetize this investment. Otherwise, why are they wasting their time?
There's a lot of hesitation on the wisdom of this. I know that. I mean, I think Hugh Thompson is a managing partner over at Crosspoint Capital. So I can see the connection back to their investment here, effectively. But I would also just as well think, okay, so if I'm a startup now submitting to the Innovation Sandbox, I need a lawyer to review the safe to make sure that it's not going to cause any issues with my existing funding. So right there, you're going to end up, a lot of people are going to self-disqualify themselves just because, you know, they don't want to go through the hassle.
There's a group of people who are not working for Crosspoint, who are, you know, experts in the cybersecurity space that review these applications. And what does that do? So, I mean, they don't work for Crosspoint. What are they going to get out of this? This just sounds weird. You know what this sounds to me like? Somebody is going to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs, expecting to find all these eggs, and it's just a simple goose inside.
So there's another interesting dynamic here, which I don't know how it's going to play out. But one of the things that we've seen over the past several years with the judges of the Innovation Sandbox is that it used to be largely consisting of CISOs and now more VCs. I think Nazrin from Verizon's the only CISO who still is on the judging panel. The VCs that are on it now...
Why would they do it?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, hey, I'm basically helping Crosspoint maybe elbow me out of actually being able to fund these companies myself.
And, yeah, there's six judges listed on there now. And so not all VC, but yeah, that'll sort itself out. I kind of think about this like, you know, when you get those... $200 Amazon gift card for taking the survey or $20 or whatever. I always think of the results need to be caveated with like 9 out of 10 CISOs who wanted a $20 Amazon gift card thought this was the best, right? There needs to be that caveat of like these are people that bid at this. So likewise, this is going to be the top 10 best companies who found the specific terms of the safe to be appealing. Up to including desperation, right? You have some chunk of them that are like, shit, money? Yeah, I'll take that. But then there's other ones that will be in just the right sweet spot. And there's going to be a bunch that are self-disqualifying to what you said earlier, Sunil, just because, I mean, think if you have existing investors, they're going to have a lot of questions about this. And when you have future investors and you have this drag along that has pro rata rights and everything else, it could impair you, right? When you're talking to other investors down the road, you're dragging along this safe from a big VC.
And the finalists include the top 10, not just the finalists, one, two,
top
it's the
10.
Old. I mean, $5 million for a startup. When I looked it up starting my own company, I was like, $5 million is a big chunk of change, early pre-seed to be giving rights to your company. I mean, that's a lot of,
it doesn't have to be pre-seed. Although it did say you have to have started after December 2023.
No, The product has to be have it released before in that time frame after 2023.
Yeah,
the company doesn't have to have started before then.
Right, totally true. But still, that means that, I mean, you're going to be pretty damn close to pre-seed if you've just started in the last, you know, looking back now, this year.
There's a certain funding threshold that you have to be under. So I don't know the exact amount, but there are many companies who've gotten pretty close to that that were in the innovation sandbox.
Well, privately owned with less than $5 million in revenue, ARR under $5 million. It's a very tight window.
This to me, I'll be the first one. I'm going to omit something here. I haven't attended an actual RSA, the conference in the conference building for a couple of 2-3 years. What I tend to be around is around the hotel rooms or some of the where you go and meet with some of these founders. You share 30 minutes, 45 minutes. You hear their product or you go visit bars and you go hang out. Hey, Jerry. Hey, Sunil. How's it going? What's going on?
Don't forget riding bikes. Right?
There you go. That's it. And that's what I've been doing. With this stuff happening, I'm like, I want to see my friends. So I don't know about this.
So it does cost extra money to go into the sandbox. So it's not free for the expo pass that everyone can get for free. Doesn't give you access
to attend,
to
you mean? Yeah.
Well, no, just to get into the sandbox, right. There's a separate pass for the sandbox that is above and beyond the expo pass. But those who do get the either the expo pass or the full pass, sorry, not the expo pass, the sandbox pass or the full pass, I've heard from many of them that between going to the main expo hall and the innovation sandbox or the early stage expo, the general feedback I've gotten is that they much prefer to go to the early stage area because that's where they see all the latest innovations.
Yeah, totally.
And I think it's a higher concentration of innovation that's happening in that area. And so, when I went to the Innovation Sandbox last year and this past year and I've gone pretty much every year too. And I was actually pretty shocked by just how packed it was. It was full, and they had overflow. And then they had a 2-hour break or so while the judges went and deliberated. And the people were supposed to come back, and like the audience was supposed to come back. And usually, in years past, there's a huge drop off in terms of the number of people who come back. But this year, it was actually packed again. The people who came back just to see who the winner was, it was packed.
Well, so Talon won last year, 2 years ago. So I mean,
they did win.
Some of these winners are big hits, right?
Well, let me ask you a little more about how this thing went, because I don't know. I'm ignorant to it. But you were a founder at the time, so you were probably paying close attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are 10 companies that have already gone through and made it to the top 10, and that's what's live?
Or that's right.
It's not like there's 100. Yeah, okay.
No, there are hundreds of companies apply.
But on the stage, so to speak, there in San Francisco, 10. It's the 10?
Yeah. It's only 10, yes.
What were the prizes, so to speak, besides claims?
Bragging rights. Okay. Bragging rights. That's it.
And now they all get the exact same safe.
And we own you for $5 million.
Well, I was going to say, it would be kind of funny if they made the terms more founder-friendly, the better you did. So, like, what you're winning is lowering the discount cap. But imagine the perverse incentive structure then, right? But, I mean, good for Crosspoint. I totally get it. I mean, they're investing. They're putting on this big show. If the room is packed, they're like, man, we have really delivered for these startups here. And we're just watching them walk away, and we got nothing to show for it. So now they're saying anybody's going to make it big once they get through this audience. We might as well have a piece of it.
Here, I think I recognize that, Jerry. I'm a little uncomfortable with the $5 million. Maybe if it was smaller, maybe between 500 and a million. It's just as a founder, you're being forced. All right, guys, you win it. Oh, price, you won. Yeah, you get $5 million that you might not want because you're already well funded, and now these.
It's strategic. You know, they want to get $50 million deployed every March or whatever it is out of their fund, and that's helping them out. So I get that too. And they also want a piece of the equity. I mean, they can't get a guarantee because they don't know what the valuation is going to be at the next raise. But $5 million means that they're probably going to have a material enough percentage to make it worth the time if you're a Crosspoint.
I think at the end of the day, the question is of choice, right? If you don't make it an option, then there are going to be companies who are just going to say, I don't think this is going to work for us. And that's ultimately going to make the pool of really interesting startups smaller as a result.
Oh, well, one other question on that note. So you haven't been a founder and seen that and everything else that they had available. Why did a company historically choose between that and what are the other things that they have? The lab, like this?
It's not that you have a choice as much. I mean, you can submit to the Innovation Sandbox, and there's no fee. So it's anybody who, you know, it's a real fair, well, relatively fair process. Where,
at least it was.
It was, yeah, maybe. But anyway, the process really started with a pretty broad range of companies. And then they get down-selected into the Innovation Sandbox. I think one of the things that we got, Nostic got this past year was the Launchpad, Startup Launchpad, which is sort of like an earlier stage of the Innovation Sandbox. And we were there were only three finalists, and apparently all three finalists were declared winners. So I was like, okay.
Everybody got a medal.
Yeah, it's sort of like, it felt kind of like a participation award, but not exactly.
I was anyway. Born. Well, I'm a winner. I'm the one. I'm the lucky.
Finish your t-shirt.
But how did you?
How did the founders, at least historically, how did they distinguish between whether to apply to the launch? I mean, is there like a
There was no cost. There's
innovation sandbags.
Yeah, they're definitely the same thresholds you talked about earlier. But again, the barrier to applying is so low. I mean, there's no cost to applying, so of course you apply.
Yeah. This will be really fascinating to see how this plays out. See what companies are there. It'd be fun to talk to some of those founders afterwards and hear what they went through mentally and assessing whether to apply anymore and how they played out, and then see if they had any regrets for winning.
We should do an episode after.
Yeah.
Oh, and to give you, so I'm just thinking through the logic for myself. So we were, of course, going to apply this coming year. Now, again, I have to have a lawyer review it before we do that. I have to just make sure that it's not going to undermine or jeopardize any other, you know, things that we may have underway. So that just, again, creates a deterrent. But I would say net, if for whatever reason we get in, and even better if we win, I mean, it is a huge publicity boost. So I would say the value of it is it worth the $5 million? Yeah. But again, will it deter a certain set of people? Probably.
Yeah, definitely some calculus going into it. And, you know, like I always say with TPRM and third-party contracts and all of that, you always win in the legal battle against somebody with nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. So you're going to pick up some people here that are like, $5 million, good. I don't even have a lawyer. I'm not going to look at that. I'm in.
Yep.
Which is a bad outcome.
Yeah. Unlimited liability for TP.
Right? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, right? Who accepted that? And then the lawyers are thumping their chests because they won. Yeah, unlimited liability means we're just going to close the shop.
That's right. Like, exactly. We're not here tomorrow. Don't worry about it. I'll take it.
Yeah. Yeah. If you think you won on that one, lawyer, sorry.
Yeah. It's cute.
All right. Pivoting on from the venture segment here. Actually, before we go out of capital markets, quick little CrowdStrike check, $370 a share, I think. So it's riding the wave for sure. It's come back. Let's see what happens with Delta. But so far, that segment of the show is looking very positive. Next thing. So Tilson Galloway, who produces this show, PhD student at Georgia Tech, awesome human being. He mentioned this to us, and it was a paper that was written mainly at a UC San Diego about phishing training. And long story short, they said it's not very effective. I've heard this so many times. I'm involved with a number of organizations where I'm close enough to the orgs that I have to take their phish training too. And of course I do it, because otherwise what kind of advocate would I be for security? And it's awful. So I kind of agree with it. Do you guys think that phish training is stupid, awesome, or somewhere in the middle with a lot of caveats?
There's the phishing simulation, which is essentially what I consider to be a vulnerability scan against an individual. And then there's the phishing training, which is what I consider to be the patch if someone is susceptible or vulnerable. If you were to ask me how good is phishing awareness training, I mean, I think generally speaking, they suck, okay? But, you know, we do it largely to check the box. But the question that really we should be asking ourselves is, why is the phishing simulation such a hated thing? And the way I've understood it is, it's like this. Let's suppose you're a fifth grader, and I give you a 12th grade calculus test. Mm-hmm. You would say, hey, that's unfair. Like, what are you expecting me to do except fail, right? Mm. Or conversely, what if I gave a fifth grade math test to a 12th grader? They'd be like, you're insulting my intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. And what we really need to do is to be able to give the fifth grader a sixth grader test and maybe the 12th grader a freshman level college test.
Yeah.
The question is, how do we calibrate that, right? How do we know what level they're at? Because let's be clear, all of us who consider ourselves to be really strong, paranoid security professionals, trust me, we can come up with a phishing simulation, a phishing email that you would click on, okay?
I failed two of them in the last 6 months.
I've almost been tempted to click on something like, oh crap, and I'm like, whoa.
No, I click, Mario. I click, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, we're professionals, you know?
So consider those to be like a PhD level phishing test, right?
Yeah, well, and let's just hope so.
If we got one of those and we considered ourselves PhD level and we failed, we'd be like, man, I got to get better. Not like, why would they dare send me this type of phishing email, right? Whereas if you gave a PhD level phishing test to a fifth grader, again, you're just setting them up for failure. And of course, they're going to be upset that you're not really giving them a real chance to succeed here. So anyway, I think part of the question is, you know, are we calibrating the tests and the training to the right level? And if we're not, well, then this is exactly what we get.
Yeah, I was about to say I disagree. I disagree is not the right word, but I would index on a different element, a different facet of this whole situation, right? And that is, so I failed a couple phishing tests that were, I clicked on the link, right? Said, hey, something, click this link, right? And I did. And then it said, ha-ha, you know, it's Snowbee4, gotcha. And I thought, so I clicked the link, who cares? I could do some research into the one-click ownage out there. Like, that's really Pegasus group type stuff. Like, there's not, now what it should have done was given me a page with a fake Outlook or Gmail and asked me to put in a name and a password, and that I'd be ashamed of. Or asked me to trust something or upload something or allow a remote connection. That's what you wanna, so you need to test against the behavior you're actually worried about. And if your users might click a link and it doesn't do anything, then go nuts, let them click the link, you know? So I think that's a huge problem. I would say we cracked this nut. At my former employer, we put a lot of time into this. We had to do it all bespoke and in-house, and it's not useful to the rest of the world, but other people could build it. So for one, we had a graded curve that said if you click a link, it's a little bit bad. If you enter information in a form, it's worse. If you double-click an attachment and you run it, it's worse than that. So and it's a literal formula for that. And then to go through the fifth grade through PhD thing that you mentioned, Sunil, one problem is you can't send 10,000 employees the same phishing test one night, because then the people who get it first will warn the other people, and then you get this misrepresentation of who's really vigilant, who's not. So we had to cut it into all these little 100 deep, but 100's still a nice population, and send these little batches out. Yeah. And then we dynamically scored the difficulty of the exam based on the failure rate. So if everybody failed, then your failure wasn't a big ding on you. Yeah. If everybody else noticed it was a fish, but you're the only one who failed, it hurt you a lot more.
Is it a question of the training materials failure to educate people on certain types of phishing attacks or not? So, because why are we running phishing simulations? Because this is a phishing simulation, what appears to be also married to a security awareness training. And what they're trying to do with phishing simulations is say, is this security awareness training program actually helping out? Okay. I think that's a fair, I think we can all agree. We don't want to be wasting people's money and time if this security awareness training is really not helping you do X. So one, I would want to understand, is this more about the training itself rather than the phishing simulation? Second, I also think, going back to security awareness training, I didn't use any third-party security awareness trainings. I did early on when I was a snowflake, but then we ended up making our own. And we had our own people doing it. And I always felt like it was better than these other materials. So this stuff is just too generic, as an example. And then you have to keep it at 5-10 minutes, the most. Yep. Make it short. make it action, make it relevant to what's happening in the zeitgeist of security during that quarter.
Of the company.
Of the company as well. Correct, correct. I will tell you that there were, the biggest thing on the secure awareness training that we always said is, here's the email, here's the phone number, here's a Slack channel. If you suspect anything, let us know. And that, I saw a lot of engagement from employees.
Yep. And you can't do that generically for every single company.
Right. That's
right.
That's
just an example of why it has to be tailored.
That's
right. Yeah, I think if you try to come up, and people have, and people are buying it all the time and wasting money on it, training that tells everybody how to spot fish, which is if it's spelled wrong. Like, you know, one day somebody could have spelled it right, and then what happens, right? Then it's worthless. But if you instead use your 5 or 10 minutes to say, here at this company, if you want to use a new cloud service, you have to get it approved first, and you go to ServiceNow, and here's the form you enter. Just one little thing. Or if you want to print from home, you're allowed to here, but it has to be data of this classification, so you're not allowed to print customer social security numbers, right? But you can print network diagrams, and you have to hook it up with a USB cable, and you can't print over your LAN because we have lateral movement protections on it. Just the company-specific, like, non-obvious things are worth an order of magnitude more than these generic bits about spotting fish.
And most of the time, these phishing simulations event, or if there's an auditor doing this, they do this for FedRAMP, right? Every time they do FedRAMP, they had to do this freaking phishing simulation by the auditor, yep. The guy. And I always frustrate. It always frustrated me when they were like, "Well, you got to turn off all your protection." I'm like, okay, yeah. I get it. I know what you're saying, but really, yeah. what are we trying to do, man?
Yeah, and by the way, turning off your protections. I know you. You're a pretty smart guy, a real good CISO. You probably knew how to turn off your protections. Edge case. Most companies go to a major bank, tell them, ask them how to turn off the protection, guarantee mail is getting delivered. No way. So you're getting benchmarked against a bunch of companies that are killing the fish in infrastructure ignorantly, yeah. Not even realizing it. It's damn near impossible. I thought it would be cool to have a proper benchmark. You know, everybody in governance wants benchmarks. So we engaged PwC. It was like a pilot, and it never went anywhere after that, but it was worth it. And we got about 12 giant financial services organizations, and we all agreed to have the same fish test run across all the organizations.
Oh.
And we started talking about relaxing the protections and all, and I just concluded I would not have confidence that everybody had really done the same things with the protections. So we said, no, leave them all in, you know?
Wow.
PwC, don't tell us what it's going to look like. No one gets any special knowledge here. And let's test the whole stack from 0365 and Proofpoint and all that other kind of stuff. And then we were able to get our org's data. And then in the backdrop, the mutualized all 12 orgs. And it was good. I thought it was really cool. You know, well, of course, we beat them, right? Of course, you beat the average and you pat yourself on the back and all of that. But I thought that the engagement idea was really cool, and I don't know if but that was the only time
material,
I've ever heard.
Jerry. That's good board material. And you can go to your board. Look how I did.
Yeah, gold dust, gold
right?
dust. Yeah, and speaking of boards, I was in a board meeting recently where we were getting fish results from the CISO. That's one of the key benchmarks that keeps coming up. I'm not a fan of it. And sure enough, there was an anomaly, something that would catch your eye in governance. Like, hey, we normally are in this range. Maybe it was normally in the high single-digit percentile failures. And then this last test, we had a 34% failure. Boom, everybody looks at it. This is a board. What should you be doing here? Well, something that piques your interest should be actionable. Like, oh, this is due to the X, or can we need a change in Y? Of course, like you would expect, it was footnotes like, oh, well, sorry. Yeah, that's because we had, it was a holiday, or that's because we accidentally used a campaign that was coincidentally exactly what HR was sending out, very similar about packages. We were just sending packages to everybody with T-shirts, and we sent the package one from No Before. So if every metric that pops gets explained away, it's not a very valuable metric. So I don't think the fish testing is working very well, but I don't think it's because it's impossible. I just think it's because people are lazy about it.
Let me challenge the lazy part of it. A lot of times we make the argument that the human is the weakest link, but I would actually counter that view that the human is actually one of the strongest links. We have an amazing ability to spot anomalies if given the right signals. And yes, we are lazy in that our system one brain looks for patterns and is, you know, the heuristic shortcuts. But to avoid some of those traps, if there were sufficient signals that could be represented through email and other and our applications and so on and so forth, then we actually can make much, much, much better decisions. Simple heuristics like, well, I mean, I don't know if people like this or not. If it works for some and it won't work for others. But, you know, the external tag on the the subject line as an example. But there are things like that that can help us make better decisions. And in many cases, it's a fault of the interface and not necessarily of the human who's looking at the interface.
Can I follow up on that, Sunil? What about enforcing the 10-20-second rule? So you press go, but it doesn't really go. It doesn't get sent. And you give the human being a moment to just like, did I do the right thing? It's this instinct, you know, like the reptilian brain that we have. We haven't left the savannas yet, okay? We're reacting. It looks like a freaking leopard out there about to eat me, or it looks like I'm going to go eat lunch as well. I can't tell. We're just reacting to it. Give it a 10-15-second delay.
Beer goggles, right? That's what it was called in Google Labs originally. You could turn on beer goggles.
We also, for many of us also instituted the interstitial page. So you click on a link and then it takes you somewhere else first. And that's essentially, I guess, what some of the URL filtering tools do. You know, the option to create an interstitial page that says, hey, this is where you're about to go. Are you sure that's where you wanted to go? Right. And so it's to your point, it's taking the reptilian brain and saying, let me get the velociraptor and get that velociraptor to come in and just help you make that better decision.
Yeah. And while we're talking about that, those URL rewrites, what a massive disservice, I think. You know, anytime I've been in an environment where I hover over the link from this email and it says safelinks.outlook.com.proofpoint.org. And it runs off the edge of the screen. And I miss the part where it says malware. North Korea.
Yes, that's right. That's
and,
right.
And for what? What did it do? Like, it's so that I could go through some proxy that's going to download the binary and execute it in a sandbox. I'm like, no, it's not. And by the way, the link is just to a page that's asking me to type something in. And well, we did that, and it's publicly resolvable, so I don't see any harm in sharing it. My goal was not to bring the links through a sandbox and execute them in a hypervisor or some BS like that. I just wanted to, when the user clicked it, to say, hey, you just clicked on a link that came in via email. Are you sure you really meant to do that? If so, copy and paste this URL from this window into your browser bar and go. That's all we did. It was secure.ice, right? We got the ice TLD. So secure.ice/?, you put in any URL in there. Right now it's publicly available, and it will give you this little speed bump page and just ask you to manually copy it in. No one's going to copy and paste a stupid newsletter link, the average spray and pray fish, whatever. It's just the regulator sent me this upload out, a little bit of a pain. I'm going to spend an extra 10 seconds. Wonderful. And more importantly, it was so short because of the TLD that you could actually see the link too and use the hover all at the same time. So just got to commercialize that and then enlist it in the innovation sandbox, and we are off.
$5 million.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. All right. So next topic. I thought this was pretty cool. CISA has just been, you know, over the last, 5 years or so, they've just been more and more active. And I love what they're doing in general and in protecting the U.S. public and beyond that. And So CISA has this weird like dual remit, and one is the United States and helping us against cybersecurity, helping the public and all businesses, and then the other is critical infrastructure. It's kind of a different animal. To the latter point, they have this suite of services, a menu that you could Google it, and after page 7,000 at a government website, you'll figure it out. You can avail yourself of free red teaming services. Technical assistance during an actual breach, forensics, all the really expensive stuff you can get for free. There's a really long line, so you're probably not going to get to it. If you're critical infrastructure, they meant to prioritize you, and so that's where all of a sudden we have that. I can say from firsthand experience they didn't necessarily always do a good job of that. I do know the org I was at finally made it through the queue and got the red teaming and all that stuff done actually after I left. So it can happen. One of those engagements, they did a, and I want to talk to someone over there and get the color behind the motivation about how they were able to do this. But they made, it's not, they don't name the company at all, but they did a public write-up of the results of one of these red team engagements against a critical infrastructure entity. And I don't think the entity said, yeah, let's let everybody learn, because they got a new one torn.
Wait, I mean, they named the company?
They did not name the company. But they basically read the Riot Act about that. You know, they didn't name the organization, but it talks about some really systemic dysfunction. And they're not a regulator where it's like a cause of action coming from the SEC or something. They're in the business of shaming people. But this is CISA, who doesn't do that.
Why?
They're not a regulator. It is a wake-up call. I mean, I think if anybody's wondering about what security is really like at a big critical infrastructure organization, they should read this, because I don't think it's an edge case. I think it's pretty, like in this case in particular, they got their initial access through a web shell that was dropped through by a researcher and submitted to them. Like someone said, hey, by the way, you have vulnerability. I could put a web shell there. It sat there for years.
No. It wasn't a, if I understand correctly, it wasn't a researcher. It was actually from a previous third-party assessment.
Yeah, I think it came in through the vulnerability disclosure program. So it's like kind of in the middle of that. But it was a good guy. Let's put it that way, right? And they were told about it. But that's just, so like some of the findings were, you're not closing out the things that you're aware of.
Well, I want to be clear here. I think the initial, I've read the report, the initial access was attained because there was a residual web shell that was left over by a legitimate third-party assessment team. Essentially, there was another team that went in to do a penetration test, and they left a residual web shell that was that they had used that to get in was used by the red team to get in as well. So this draws a couple of interesting questions. First is, did the previous team clean up after themselves after having done their assessment? Okay. And the possibility of that happening, I mean, there's a possibility that the previous team might have been sloppy and they didn't clean up after themselves.
Wait, let's make sure you come back to that. I didn't think that was standard expectation is for red teams to clean up after themselves. But
that's standard, man. You got to clean up your mess. No, really, that is pretty standard.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. If the red team, if a previous team, if I've contracted out somebody to go and do an assessment against me and they don't clean up after themselves, and they leave gaping holes that someone else discovers, that's a really bad thing.
They give you on the report, I've left this file, it's in this folder.
I'm assuming they did do that. Yeah. Well, when we had these things, we would have to clean them up. And I remember it very specifically because we wrestled with if it was an actual a real web shell ever, we burned the whole damn system. We'd always image it. Always wipe the whole damn system.
Okay.
So we'd wrestle with, this is from a red team, do we burn it or not? And if we had source code and we sure it wasn't malicious, we were comfortable just deleting it. But it was on us. Nobody else was cleaning up behind themselves for us.
Yeah, I mean, for an endpoint, you would just nuke the machine. For a server, what you would do is restore from a backup. Mm. Now, here's the other possibility that may have happened, that the backup had the web shell. So in other words, let's suppose I went in and cleaned. I went in as an assessor, dropped the web shell, and then after I'm done, I clean up the web shell. The company I assessed says, okay, yeah, we need to go. We don't know what else might be still on there, so let's go back to a previous backup. Well, guess what? That backup could have still had that web shell. So anyway, we don't know exactly how it transpired, but the point is that there's a couple possibilities. One is sloppiness on the part of the assessor. The other part is possibly restoring from a tainted backup.
Put a script that restarts when your backup has a script in it that restarts. Every time it restarts, runs the script to go outbound, can make a connection to HTTPS bound, and bring the new instructions. That's lovely. Yeah,
hey, for what it's worth, like while we were talking there, I realized why there was some confusion, right? So this actual report, it's worth picking it apart. It says, you know, gain initial access from a web shell left from a third party's previous security assessment. At that point, I'm thinking, you know, they had a NCC group or something come in and they didn't clean up. And then the next time they discover it, they say web shell left from a previous vulnerability disclosure program, VDP. What? And then they continue to use the term VDP to describe a test they had. That's not what a vulnerability disclosure program is. So I don't know what exactly they mean by that. But yeah, kind of weird.
So what are we saying? I mean, are we talking about, is the CSAP program not worth it and you should never engage? Or is it more a reflection of the customers? What's our meta message here?
I think the
CSAP program is fantastic. They're not even potentially the ones who didn't clean up. They just rode on whatever they found from before. They may have mischaracterized what they found before, how it got there. But to TLDR for everybody, it's the classic big financial or other org infrastructure stack. They get in, they went through some Linux-based, you know, forward-facing, customer-facing stuff, pivoted, got to Active Directory, DC Sync, all the old school red team playbook. All the technical issues in here were classic infrastructure flatness, lack of segmentation. They did lateral movement, not a ton of malware vulnerability exploitation and CVEs. Just like in all real attacks, it's rarely actually CVEs and vulns. It's living off the land, using existing credentials, DC sync, cracking passwords, all that kind of stuff. And CISA's rocking along in this article, and I'm loving it. And it looks like, you know, engagements you pay $40,000 for, and someone got a lot of value for free. It's awesome here. And then they all of a sudden pivot to the punchline, which is, and that's why you need to do secure by design in your SDLC.
Wow.
Like,
wow.
What the hell does that have to do with infrastructure exploitation? And that's what I keep getting. Like, they keep on pushing the secure by design program, and I'm saying 99% of the long tail of companies shouldn't have to be over-focused on AppSec. They should just worry about credentialing and that kind of thing. And they somehow try to tie the two things together.
You know where I have my theory about these exploit vulnerabilities and looking at vulnerabilities for exploit? I think everybody's going back to the early days for WooFTP, when you can go and just send a command WooFTP and just throw a vulnerability gain shell on that. And I think people are still remembering those days, or even maybe IIS 4 or 5, IIS 5, Microsoft's IIS.
Oh, how about WinNuke?
I mean, let's WinNuke.
Further back, right? We're all old enough that we were WinNuking each other. Yeah.
Yeah,
but you know, I mean, the problem isn't just that they remember that. The problem is that then everybody swept in and built phone scanners and then raised $250 million in collective funding from people who were going to march into the world and tell everybody how CVEs were all we need to worry about. So we've done this to ourselves. Like, the ecosystem kind of amplifies the narrative that gets satisfied by the product for sale.
I want to go back to the secure by design comment. I think the secure by design initiative is this, first of all, it's a bigger umbrella than just the like SDLC and so on and so forth. It's six principles that they use to undergird secure by design. Like, for example, secure by default, or making MFA mandatory or just consistently applied. But that said, I actually have a different view of secure by design, because I think much of what they do isn't necessarily about security, but just about there's a lot of practices that they articulate, like, for example, logging and monitoring, which I think is not even, to me, it's like a foundational thing that anybody in IT would care about, not just security. So having good telemetry of your environment is something that the operators would care for. And if you don't have that, then it's something that you will regret, not from a security standpoint, but just because you don't know what's going to happen in your environment. So anyway, there's this notion of secure by design, which I think puts us in a situation where it feels like, hey, security is imposing its will upon us in some way. Whereas I think there's some core principles that apply universally that should be more emphasized and saying, for example, you know, like, hey, you know what, logging and monitoring is just a good, like, good practice overall that you should do.
But it's extraordinarily expensive and difficult. I think that's underplayed. Like, detections, when we talk about that in hygiene, and we go along and kind of roll our eyes and go, oh, I can't believe they didn't even have all their logs consolidated in the SEM and someone monitoring that. That is not trivial.
I agree. I totally agree. The principle, the there's also a question of, like, what's the appropriate amount of content to actually log. But if you have no logging, then that's, I mean, you don't want either opposite, I think, at the end of the day.
I think you need a balanced approach. I think the idea is, I mean, I look at I'm a believer in some logging and some monitoring, actively looking at errors that are happening in the environment. Mm-hmm. You're looking for misconfigurations, right. Okay? I mean, the idea for me is I don't go to a doctor. You know, I'm just going to be healthy. I'm going to try to be healthy. I'm going to eat well. I exercise every day. That's not the case, but I'm just going to say that. But I don't go to doctors. I don't do a yearly checkup. I'm not the one to monitor. And next thing you know, something bad happens. I fall and die. But hey, I was living a healthy lifestyle. I was secure by design, but never monitor myself. Now, I think you need a little monitoring.
And to the point about it being expensive, one of the recommendations I made to DHS many years ago was, if we're going to fund, let's say, government agencies specifically to help bolster their security program, one of the best spends of that money is actually to offset or subsidize the cost of monitoring. And I think that goes a long way to help us at least know when someone's been compromised, not, you know.
I mean, I something like that is almost like a macroeconomic initiative, meaning, like, if you wanted to help someone, be resilient against some kind of disease that's really plaguing the area, and you just get $200 million, no, it's not going to make any difference on any individual victims. They're all going to die either way. Like, the $200 million might foster education. Yeah. And, you know, 40 years from now, you'll lower the overall macro rate from 60% down to 6%, and that's good. But it's not going to abate the acute issue, right? And the reason I brought that up is because if you take the average org who's struggling with monitoring, and it's not a dentist office, it's not that kind of thing, it's fast-growing companies who are deploying cloud service providers, no less instances and containers, much faster than anyone could even chase them around and tell them about monitoring. So money's not the issue. When I say it's expensive, it's not that. It's expensive because of the lost revenue when you shut down progress and you say, whoa, we're not going to deploy any new tools until we go back and retrofit everything to have logging. That's the expense that DHS can't help with, or that the government can't help with. So, I mean, if you had a massive budget and a macro application that you're going to spend it on, where would you invest to make this problem go away in 20 years?
Well, I think this is where I would go back to the macroeconomic sort of view of things here to say that if we lower the bar for logging and monitoring, the actual costs for logging and monitoring to go down, then it creates another ecosystem that says, okay, what can we actually do with this? And I think the meaningful use of that logging and monitoring is something that I think will create a whole new ecosystem around as well.
Yeah, I have such a hard time with this. I got to be really adversarial. I really do. I'm not looking to log the payload, the content, any of that. I want to see person X on this machine did some action on this day, on this time. I don't need more than that. Maybe, Jerry, your point is we're making this logging more verbose, capturing more than we need. Could you make it simpler, just looking at actions that people are doing?
I'll put it a different way.
Yeah.
Imagine, if you will, a company that has a logging problem. Right, it's a technology company, maybe to make a SaaS platform, and you've done a review there, and maybe a forensic review, and you're like, man, we couldn't find logs for anything during this. We have a problem. And you tell the board, and now we go into this bizarre world where the board says, that's unacceptable. We're committed to fix it. We're going to give you $200 million, CISO. Problem solved. Fix the logging. You think that logging problem is going to be solved with $200 million? What are you going to spend it on? You're going to buy a bunch of people to walk in? How's that going to go well for you? bunch of strangers from Big Four Consulting to hover around your engineers and tell them what to type. You can buy a bunch of databases and SEMs and clusters. I mean, you know what I mean? It's not a money problem.
No, you're right. It is expensive.
It's expensive in a business sense. And that's a long game.
You certainly have to understand the business. I'm not debating that. And I think that's where some of the cost is born. I think they're still, again, lowering the cost, the burden of saying, like, for example, let's just say we go from 2 weeks of monitoring to 3 months of monitoring of a restricted set of content, right? And at least gives us a sporting chance to be able to find something that may have happened many months ago that we would have otherwise lost. I think at the end of the day, I'm not suggesting that we subsidize monitoring to make it so that people just collect without really thinking to what they're collecting. There was an NSA program called Trailblazer way back in the day where the goal was to basically just suck everything down, and it ended up being a failure because they were awash in too much
overwhelmed with data,
logs.
Just too much
right.
logs, too much log, too much
yeah. right. So we definitely don't want that. But that said, if people are scrimping and saving because it costs too much and they actually know what they want, then I think we should try to find a way to lower that burden.
I think that how long you keep certain these logs, I think that is there's an argument for having less, honestly.
Signal noise ratio.
What is that, Jerry?
Signal to noise ratio.
Correct.
All right. Yeah,
right.
Noise.
I mean, I think it has to do more with maybe financial. Maybe it comes from the financial world that you have to keep records for 4 or 5 years, 6 years. Maybe that's what it is. And that's why we got a little verbose on the whole logging. So I'll acknowledge your point, Jerry. You are why we're spending a lot of money on some of this logging stuff. But the idea of not logging and monitoring and alerting on some of that, I'm not there, man. I wouldn't do it. I'm not with you on that.
But I think that the people that are running around preaching, it's not if but when, every organization's breach, you just don't know it yet, all that, are doing a disservice because then we shift. I mean, you remember in financial services, Sunil, you could probably remember the day. It was probably 8 years ago when every big CISO suddenly just only started saying resilience. You know, every talk was about resilience. What about resilience? And that never made sense to me because the last thing you want us to see so is to be responsible for resilience, right? I mean, wasn't the IT org going to do that? You're going to rebuild the infrastructure as the CISO? Hell no. So how are you going to shift everything to resilience? That to me is like giving up. Like, oh yeah, well, don't worry. After we get owned, we're going to do the best job ever of going to Best Buy and buying new laptops. Hey, another thing, because we weren't being technical enough at all, I think we should go into the weeds. Cookie theft, all right? Session cookie theft in particular. This thing has been driving me nuts. So there were some articles out recently. FBI Atlanta, actually, who has a strong cyber team here, they put out a notice about this being an element of a lot of attacks lately, was stealing session cookies, in particular for the big, what I'll call IDPs, Google and Microsoft. So you steal someone's cookie that had the fruit of their remember me for 30 days clicking, and now they replay it from another machine in Uzbekistan, and it lets them surf right in. It bypasses the MFA, all the cool stuff that they had configured on there. And that's apparently just rampant, and that's plaguing the world right now.
But are we including cookie with session IDs as well? I mean,
session
I think
IDs in a cookie. A session ID stored in a cookie. And by the way, this isn't rogue, weirdo, no secure by design type people. This is Google.
Well, okay, so now imagine this. Okay, Sunil, I'm getting fired up about this. This is one of the ones I get excited about a lot because it's, in my opinion, really impactful and real. If we use Google today, Google Gmail, you're using it on your Chrome browser, okay? You can set up, one, as a company, you can set up policies for that OAuth token that you get. And that OAuth token can be, I'll kill it after 7 days. It won't be, so you'll expire, you'll get issue a new OAuth token. Great, wonderful. The minute you go into one of these phones and you're using a FAT client that may not be the Google FAT client, you might be using another operating system's email, that OAuth policy goes out the door. You can't enforce it. In other words, that OAuth token is valid not for a month, not 2 months, but for several months. So it's sitting there. It's got your session. Of course, as an attacker, I'm going to go get that session.
Yeah. It's a mess. I mean, I started digging into it, and I found this paper. So what you need, right, is device-bound session cookies. So you take it, you go to log in somewhere else, and it's not the same device. I don't care. You have the cookie. That's not good enough. Seems kind of trivial, especially if you're in a 1994 mindset and you're thinking, oh, the IP address. Right? Different IP address. Don't let the cookie work. And I guess the problem with that is IP addresses, I mean, we always knew they could be ephemeral, but they're really ephemeral, like when you're on mobile and you're in the train, and especially at scale.
Yeah.
So what I read Google's approach to this, Google as like the research part of Google, right? This isn't like necessarily what they're going to do, is to use TPMs. So they'll generate a key pair on a device in the TPM. They'll use that to sign something involved with submitting the data out of the cookie, I presume, so that if you don't have access to that trusted processing module on a device, which is up to and including phones, or iOS has that, or iPhones do, then the cookie will be unusable. And they've been, and it sounds like it's a big endeavor. They have like a roadmap. It's like a year-long project to even test the viability of this. So maybe that's the solution?
So Microsoft does actually have a solution, but I don't know if I would say it's easy to apply or cheap to apply. So it's tied to like their conditional access policy that basically enables us to set parameters around the use of any credentials, including session tokens and whatnot. And the like, for example, you can create geolocks around the use of a particular token, so that if someone did steal it, you have to find yourself in that same geography, whatever it might be. Again, it's not going to completely thwart somebody. If someone's in the same geography, let's say from a laptop where they've hacked into their computer and using their Wi-Fi, let's say, we'll see situations where, you know, they'll be they can bypass that geolock. But anyway, that's it. There are ways to restrict that. It just requires the ability to configure conditional access, which, by the way, I don't know if it's default in every instance. I mean, I'm not sure if it's part of the lowest tier license of Microsoft 365, but it is something that serves as an option for those who have it.
Well, and I'll tell you, I should say, Google has that. Enterprise. Mm-hmm. It's paywalled. All this stuff is paywalled.
Yeah.
And the reason CISA's writing about this isn't because, you know, the nuclear power company was the only one being hit. It's Gmail. It's the public. It's widespread. And all
people
of them can't.
It's widespread.
They can't do conditional access, you know?
Yeah.
For me, I was trying to configure it on my home computer. You know, I log in a Chrome on my home computer. And this isn't an enterprise. This isn't a workspace thing. This is just my personal domain. And I don't want that to be cookied. I don't want to be able to launch that and just log right in when it's a shared computer. And I'll be damned if I can configure that to actually force me to auth every single time I log in, unless I actually log out on my own every single time I'm done. But otherwise, it will stay there. And I've gone through all the Google settings and all of that. Very difficult.
Yeah, at the end of the day, we were looking at the trade-off as well, because the more restrictive that you end up making it, the larger your help desk costs are going to be, right?
Yeah.
And there's a cost that's borne on everyone that lowers their productivity. At some level, I mean, let me just throw this out there as for consideration. Is the cost of all the lost productivity greater than what would ever we would get stolen from a hacker?
Passkeys. Passkeys to the rescue.
Yeah.
Passkeys. That's the intersection of this and usability. Yeah.
Passkeys. Yeah.
I'll use an example of that, right? So I use an enterprise browser at home, believe it or not, because I'm an advisor to Island. So full disclosure, in the process of explaining how it came to be.
Yeah.
And when I use that to check my work email from that home computer, and I only log into Island, and Island prompts me, and I use the QR code with my phone, and I have a passkey that's on the iCloud keychain, which I am comfortable with, and that's usability is fine. The UX is great there.
I think that so there's a The problem is once you authenticate, you know, your Oktas, your Google's, Azure's, and we talked about this in the past, you get your token, you then go to the application, let's say a SaaS application. A SaaS application gives you a session ID, okay? SaaS session ID, that Okta token it was a fine just to get you in the front door. It's the SaaS applications that then generate a session ID for you, and then they have long-lived secrets. Sessions. There's just not a meeting of the minds between the two parties. I remember talking to one of these IDPs, the CEO of one of these big major IDPs, and he had been trying going on this personal jihad of his to get the SaaS companies, major SaaS companies, and the IDPs to even just do global logoff. Such a wonderful idea, global logoff. It couldn't make it work. Hasn't made it work because SaaS companies don't want to do it. So I'm bringing back this whole session ID. I love the TPM idea. The enclave technologies, for the love of God, use freaking enclave as much as possible. Store the
finally,
things.
Crypto could buy us something. Exactly.
But they're not doing it. The SaaS companies are not doing it.
Yeah. No, you're so right. You go through Okta, you go through all these hoops, you could have it, you know, actually like test your blood for login and all that. And then the minute it hands it off to Google, you could be out of Okta. You know, I mean, you could do session revocation, which is a very unique thing for different things. But as far as like session expiry, that kind of thing, doesn't matter.
Zero trust. Zero trust goes vapor trust.
Yeah, whatever happened to zero trust? I thought that was supposed to be the thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, plus the trust.
Right.
Yeah.
Zero trust right. Only at the front door of the IDP, but no zero trust once you go to advanced, go to the SaaS application.
Yeah,
because that
exactly.
goes at the door.
So from the, we should have a segment on here. We have one for the CrowdStrike price every time. And then from the things that are going to be on the news that most people shouldn't ever worry about, we have Fancy Bear hopping Wi-Fi networks. I wanted to make that preface because when we pop these things in the show, I don't want anybody to mistakenly think, oh, they're saying we need to worry about this. It's more, someone else is going to tell you to worry about this, and I'm here to tell you, don't worry about it. But you guys might have a different take. Russian spies jump from one network to another via Wi-Fi in an unprecedented hack brought to you by the security vendor who publicize this.
The 90s, the 90s call, they won their Russian malware back. This is Xenio.
Well, okay, so to the point about this being unprecedented, I think that's kind of a silly, it's a bit of a stretch there. I think we've all been concerned about our Wi-Fi networks. And so let's talk about what the story is about. So the story is that Russians are attacking computers nearby a target network, okay? And so they compromise a laptop, and that's like close enough to another facility that has Wi-Fi, either guest Wi-Fi or their corporate Wi-Fi, and they then use that computer as a jumping point and as a beachhead to attack this other corporate network, which presumably the first laptop is not part of that corporate network. It's just a guest computer, right? All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So the whole point of that is just to say, look, this is, whether it's a Russian or somebody just walking down, you know, visiting their local Starbucks, and not because they want to use the Starbucks Wi-Fi, but because they want to use your Wi-Fi. If you don't have controls for those things, then you got other problems. I wouldn't worry about the Russians. I'd just be like, you know, you got tons of people who are going to come in and use your guest Wi-Fi, or if they've done the opportunity to do credential stuffing of employees that you have, you know, that may have lost passwords and such. That's another opportunity. Now, the only thing that's really different about this one, that's distinct from what I've mentioned just now, is the ability to potentially do this at scale. Okay, so let's suppose at some
Wi-Fi.
Level,
a wormy Wi-Fi.
Well, no, not that kind of scale. But let's just say, let's suppose that I have presence in many different machines across the world. Okay, Okay, now from there, what if I do credential stuffing of corporate passwords from that vantage point? That becomes a bit more interesting, okay? But it also causes us to say, okay, we should, again, have maybe a little bit better logging and monitoring to see what that type of activity.
But we've had that happen all the time. I've had it where they do credential stuffing. I mean, they used to do, Anonymous used to do not stuffing, but they would do a UDP blast away by leveraging other machines that were allowing that UDP printer to be exploited. And then they did a reflection attack on
reflection
some other
attacks,
victim.
Yeah.
That's right. Remember that? It's a little bit.
NTP. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
But here's the question that I have, which is there any throttling or lockout if I try to authenticate into a corporate Wi-Fi hotspot?
Well, I'll go a step further, right? So I think my whole take on all this stuff is assume people aren't going to get all this good stuff done, right? Back to the logging thing. Right? No one's going to log, even the $200 million. or no one's going to be there to look at the logs, even if they do log, and on and on. When it comes to this scenario, right, we're saying, A, you're letting someone get into your corporate Wi-Fi must be some low barrier to entry, because once they pop this box across the street, they were able to get in the corporate Wi-Fi. So it's more than just scanning. So I'm going to go even further and say no one's going to secure the corporate Wi-Fi either. It's not going to have a password on it, or it's going to be a guessable password, all that. I'm okay with that. I'm living in the real world here. Don't have a freaking corporate Wi-Fi. Let's wind back the clock 20 years ago when Wi-Fi came out, 25, whatever. It doesn't have to be connected to the privileged network. Put
Correct.
It on the internet, coffee shop model, and your employees get on there, and they don't have access to anything. Then they
Correct.
VPN, use the ZTNA thing, then they multi-factor, all that. There was no reason to ever keep up with stupid Wi-Fi standards. If you're in that arms race and you're reading the tweets and upgrading the encryption protocol every other week, that's stupid. Just put your employees on public Wi-Fi. They're going to be on it when they go to Starbucks anyway. And when the Russians get on it, let them surf the web. But nothing else.
Yeah, correct. So you can get that can of sprinkle, the sprinkle can, what was it, that they used for the antenna? They would be driving so you could capture all the
Wires.
Exactly.
Remember the war driving?
So that's what these guys are trying to do.
Kudos to you, Jerry, for not saying the word zero trust.
did I avoid it? Did I dance? So, I mean, I do think if there's anything, for one, most organizations don't worry about this.
Well,
it's so targeted.
Not that you don't worry about it, but I think you, to Jerry's point, you have to redesign or design your environment so that Wi-Fi, corporate Wi-Fi, is not a point of failure, right? But I don't know if that describes a lot of people. But that said, I still agree, generally speaking, that this is not something that most organizations should care about. You can certainly have a better design to avoid the problem altogether. But I think the other point I was trying to make is there are a lot of things that we limit our thinking based on human scale execution. And if we can do machine scale execution, what sort of assumptions are no longer valid? And I mentioned this a while back, I think, in terms of open source and eyeballs. This is maybe another situation where if you can do machine scale type of activities, you know, let's say that they have access to lots of different endpoints, and from those different endpoints, they can do some degree of automation to brute force different things. Does that change the equation in some meaningful way?
What's the economic return on that? I would rather just go through the VPN of that. If I'm already on that laptop, I already own the laptop for that, whatever that user is. And if they have a corporate VPN, I'm going in there and sneaking on the VPN. Why bother on somebody's Wi-Fi?
They're assuming that you don't have access to that target entity.
Oh, no, I'm not. I know what they were using is somebody else's laptop that doesn't belong to that company, that's somehow sitting, like they're in an apartment complex next to this big protected building that they want.
Right.
But I'm like, imagine somebody's laptop, you're already on their laptop? My goodness, I can make more money out of that. I can go find some other things I can use that laptop for. I'm sure they have their VPN to their actual companies that I can then go sneaking in there and ransomware, make money.
But that's not the motivation in particularly, and I believe in this particular case, if it's espionage, right?
Oh, well, to Neil's point, one thing I could see coming out of this, so every time people talk about IoT security, and I'm going to beat the drum again that I think that's totally overrated by companies that are doing IoT protections. IoT gets popped because of the SaaS portal. You log into the... Nobody's cracking Nest cameras. Oh, you see all these like urgent 0 days in an IoT device.
Yeah.
Who cares? No one's got lateral access to it. Everybody just goes through the command console, you know, credential stuffing. Oh, I can view your cameras now because they do a reverse shell up to the cloud. The things could be vulnerable as hell. So could your TV and your speakers and all that stuff. But no one can get layer three routing to them. So who cared? Okay, maybe now they care. Because if you weaponize this at scale, Sunil, you would suddenly see a lot of RFC 1918 IP addresses that are full of vulns that, to my point, didn't matter before, and now they could suddenly matter. So don't let any of the bad guys hear that part.
Jerry, when your significant other starts yelling at you because her refrigerator, your refrigerator got compromised, it's no longer working, and all your food has gone bad.
It's through the portal.
You can explain it to them, all right? Explain it to them. This is silly. Why are we protecting our IoTs?
Yes. So if this happens and it scales and it masks, there's these massive global mesh networks that get lateral movement in all these local lands, it'll probably be have been committed by the OT protection vendors. Conspiracy theory hatching.
I just think it was some guy working for the Secret Service for Russia pitched this idea to his general and said, I got a great idea. What do you think of this?
Mayhem.
He's like, yes, let's do it. Let's go. Sounds brilliant. Yes. I did not know who supported this. It's crazy.
Yeah, heard it here first.
Yeah.
Well, cool, guys. This was a real real detailed one. We really got the weeds here, but it's fun as always working with you guys. I appreciate the different perspectives. And let's march into the holidays now. I hope you guys have get some travel here and really enjoy it and enjoy some family time. And we'll be back soon.